Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host today. And today we're going to be talking about deferred sales trusts. This is kind of one of those topics that you probably never heard about before, but you really want to know because I know I've looked into this and it's really got some fantastic opportunities, especially for some of you listeners in the show who are investing in real estate and other topics where this would come into play. So Brett, welcome to the show.
Kirk, thanks for having me.
Tell the listeners a little about yourself and your background.
I live in Sacramento, California. I'm born and raised in kind of the Bay Area, Mission, San Jose, Fremont area in the 1980s with when the 49ers were great and MC Hammer was rocking and rolling with his music. So that's kind of my early days. Fast forward, I played sports and studied commercial real estate when I was in college. Started helping people buy and sell commercial real estate, mainly through multifamily investing. And you know, I live here with my wife and five kids, a surrounding family. But my focus is always sort of been a commercial real estate and helping people create and preserve more wealth in that arena, which then has led to the tax deferral strategy we're going to talk about.
We brought you on to talk about the deferred sales trust. Can you tell us a little about what it is to start?
Yeah, deferred sales trust is a manufactured installment sale. And a better way to think about it is it's a seller carry back, but it's with a third-party trust that gives you much more flexibility. And so, for example, let's imagine, Kirk, you owned a business and I wanted to buy your business and I didn't have a lender. You said you would lend. Well, if you carry back a note, in that scenario, you became the lender and therefore the tax is deferred. It's not triggered. And so what we do is we just have a third party trust come in and do the same thing, except now we have much more flexibility. So big picture, it's just an installment note. It just happens to be specialized to give you much more flexibility.
So what you're saying is, let's say I have a business, let's say I have a medical practice and I sell it for $10 million and I don't want to pay all the taxes this year, I want to defer it over time. This would be why I would use a DST?
Exactly right. So most business owners would think about it as a traditional seller carry back, which is good because you could do it over a period of time. Whereas the deferred sales trust, you can go for as long as you want. So a traditional installment sale is mostly 3 to 5 years, right? It's short in nature. And generally speaking, you're going to pay the tax anyways, although you got a little bit of savings. Whereas the deferred sales trust can go for as long as you want. So 10, 20, 30, 40 years, pass it on to your kids. They can keep going as well. So it's just much, you look at the time value of money and you look at the comparisons and it becomes much more attractive.
So what you're saying is I sell this $10 million business and I want to defer it over 100 years. I could do that?
Correct.
So let's just talk about some applications here before we get into more of the details, which are all very important. But let's say I wanted to take like 3% a year from this business. You know, that's all I needed for retirement. So I wanted, let's say the next 40 years, I want to take 3%. So I could defer this over that 40-year period and take my 3% a year, whatever it ends up being. That's something I could do and then pay taxes on that 3% every year?
Correct. Yes. Most of our notes are 10-year notes at any given time. They earn 8% on average over any 10-year period of time. And they net you, the client, about 6.5%. Now, some of our clients will just live off the 3%. Let's just say that's what you needed. And so in the scenario, if you sold a $10 million business, let's imagine you had a zero basis and a $4 million tax liability with the depreciation recapture, we like to say, would you like to have $6 million or 10 in the trust minus some fees? And you say, well, I'd like to have 10 in the trust minus some fees. And then we set the note based upon your needs and your risk tolerance. And you might say, you know, I need 3%. And I say, okay, well, let's have it set at 3%. As that 3%, hopefully we've earned that in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or investment real estate, or another business venture. And so that 3% is going to be ordinary income tax that you receive. But that $10 million is still in place. So it's sort of like a loan to you that's of zero interest. So the government says, look, we'll give you this $4 million loan. You owe it to us a 0% interest rate as long as you invest it into the marketplace, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, but very flexible along the way. And then yes, eventually, if you want it to cash out completely, you'll pay tax on all of it in that given tax year rate. But most of our clients will just live off the interest and keep that principal in place.
Let's continue to use this example because I think this would be helpful. So let's say that $10 million, how do you invest it? Because you're getting back 3% a year. So how's that $10 million invested?
So it's based upon how and where you would like it invested. So it could be stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and it's based upon a risk tolerance questionnaire that you fill out. It's about 12 or 13 questions, and it talks about your needs, your risk, and where you like it invested. And then a financial advisor, which is not our role. We're just the trustee or the third-party trustee, but the financial advisor comes in and says, hey, how's this allocation look, Kirk? Based upon your risk tolerance, does that look pretty good? And you say yes or no, or let's adjust it a little bit. But again, most of our notes are structured about 8%. And that's a moderate over any 10-year period, moderate amount of risk. And in our 24-year track record and thousands of these trusts being closed with our financial advisors that we've worked with, all of them have been able to achieve that as well. And so some years might be 14%, some years might be negative 2%. But any given 10-year period of time, we've been able to earn about 8% for the majority of our clients. Now, your risk tolerance might be a little bit lower. You might say, you know what, I really don't want to lose any of the money. Let's go lower. And then in that sense, we lower that target rate to 7, to 6, to 5. 5 is about our lowest, but it's adjustable and flexible based upon what you want, Kirk. And then if you want to go back into real estate, which is my favorite part, because I'm an investment real estate professional and own, you know, senior housing, multifamily, and retail interest. And so we like to put it back into investment real estate. And here's the key. You can do it at any time, meaning you can sell high, sit on the sidelines, and buy back whenever you want to. So really flexible, Kirk.
Yeah, and we'll get into real estate in a minute because I know there's a whole other rabbit hole we can go down with that. So basically, you can invest in whatever you want. Is this all paid out? Is the gain, that $10 million gain that I have, is that paid out as a capital gain or is that paid out as income?
So let's walk through it. Say it's $10 million and let's imagine it's earning the 8% after fees. You're netting about 6.5%, but you're living off the 3%. Now on that 3%, you're still in the interest portion. That'd be taxed as ordinary income. Now, if you dipped into principal, let's imagine you say, hey, I want $1 million out the next year. Let's dip into the principal. For that $1 million principal you dipped into, that'd be taxed at capital gains tax rate.
Okay, good. So yeah, so that $10 million, that part, the principal is at the capital gains rate. It's the earnings would be as income, right? Is it all in interest income or are there also gains mixed in there? So if you invested in, let's say, the S&P 500 and sold it 3 years later, is that still treated as income or is that gains?
I would say that's the CPA tax attorney question. So my role is the nurse, but in those particular details, we would dig in with the tax attorney and CPA because every allocation is a little bit different. And those are all treated differently as well. So I would defer to them on that.
Okay. No, that's fine. Yeah. And just for reference, nurses do a good part of the work. So
it's true.
Yeah. All right. So you've got this great benefit way to pass taxes on into the future and a way to structure it. Sounds like it's something that can be, you structure it up front. It sounds like it can be edited along the way. You know, you can take out parts of the principal and what have you, right?
It's adjustable and flexible along the way.
Okay. Can somebody just do this themselves or what kind of parts of the puzzle do people need to actually get this done?
And so it's a proprietary structure. And we like to say, don't try this at home, right? Because the biggest things, if anyone approaches you with a new tax strategy, you want to make sure that the professionals have a track record with the IRS and as well with clients. And so the best analogy is a doctor. You know, imagine you're going to your general practitioner and he's giving you blood work and he's taking care of some of the general stuff for the last 20 years. But now you're going to sell your business that you've built up or your commercial real estate. That's a big transaction. You're probably not going to have him perform the surgery, right? The surgeon is the tax attorney, right? And they're the creators of the structure. It's proprietary and all roads lead back to the same law firm. Although we have other law firms that work with us as well and that advise for other clients who want an outside opinion. But essentially, it's roads lead back to that law firm. And we want to make sure you're working with somebody who actually has faced the IRS with their actual clients and has survived those audits. And so that's the track record of the 14 no change IRS audits. And you heard me correct. It's all no change, not one single issue with the trust. The largest deal was a $125 million deal in San Diego. It's a commercial real estate property, no changed audits. And so when I first learned about it at Marcus & Millichap about, you know, 10 or 11 years ago, we just said, you know, can this thing really work? Will it really survive the legality? And as we looked at the track record, as we looked at the people who've closed it and the IRS audits being no change, that really gave us a whole lot of confidence to move forward. So some of the key components is for the legal minds that are listening to this as well, our business purpose and third-party unrelated trustee. And so that's actually our role at Capital Gains Tax Solutions. We're the exclusive deferred sales trust trustee, and we provide the third-party unrelated part of that to maintain the integrity of the trust. So for example, Kirk, I couldn't be your son or relate it to you in any way because I would be basically a related party, which would trigger the tax. And so as long as I'm not related to you, I could be the trustee for your deal. The next thing is business purpose. I must be in it for business purpose, meaning I must be able to make a profit and make income or make fees off of it, which we do. We charge fees and we can make a profit at the end of it. It's a small percentage of it, but we can make a profit. When those two things combined and you taking back 100% financing from the trust, we're following all the rules and we're staying within the guardrails. So that's not only the structure and the idea, but it's actually the execution of this. And this is where we have the tax law firm who provides that, who connects with your CPA. We have Capital Gains Tax Solution, who's the trustee. And then there's the financial advisor who's managing the funds. They're all separate entities, but we're all working as a team to make all of this work.
Let's talk about some of the structuring rules, because I know there's some specific things. So there's a lot of similarities. In some ways, it sounds like a little bit like an IRA, and in some ways, it's kind of like a 1031 exchange. So maybe you can kind of talk about some of the differences between a DST and like a 1031 and an IRA.
Absolutely. And here's the premise. You know, most investment commercial real estate owners, high-end primary homeowners or business owners, they struggle with capital gains tax somewhere between 30 and 50% of their gain when they go to sell. And so that's defining the problem. So it's going to happen at a sale and it's highly appreciated. And there's probably 30 to 50% that's going to be wiped out. Now we use the deferred sales trust. That's the mechanism. That's the tool. That's the strategy to give the tax deferral, liquidity, diversification. And the best part, which from my perspective is the ability to buy real estate at optimal timing. So what do we mean by that? Well, the 1031 exchange too often creates what I call the 180-day sprint. And so for your listeners who don't know what that 1031 exchange is, essentially it's another strategy. It's based upon IRC 1031, which is a section of the tax code, which allows you to trade like-kind investment real estate for like-kind investment real estate. Now, there's certain rules you have to follow. You have to buy it within 180 days. You have to identify one, two, or three properties, and there's a couple other ways, but most folks do the three-property rule within 45 days. The next rule is you have to buy with equal or greater value, which oftentimes means equal or greater debt. So our parents taught us to sell high and buy low, but unfortunately, especially in today's marketplace, people are selling high and 180 days later, they're buying higher, sometimes at a higher interest rate. And we call this the candle burning at both ends. And the candle represents your return, Kirk, right? And the bigger the candle, the better it is. But if the candle keeps burning, what's burning on this side? Well, we're getting lower cap rates, which means higher prices, lower inventory, which means higher prices. And the other side, until recently, we've seen interest rates that have risen in the last 5 years, generally speaking. And so as that happens, you get smaller and smaller returns. So you sell high and buy higher. So the intent is to sell high and buy low. The challenge is the 1031 is restrictive and you have to buy within that time frame. So the solution is the deferred sales trust. We can now sell high, put it into stocks, bonds, mutual funds, which are not like-kind, which we don't have to follow that because we're IRC 453, which is a different part of the section of the tax code, which have different rules. Both of them are tax deferral strategies. By the way, IRC 453 goes back to the 1920s, again, known as a seller carryback. And so now we're parked in the trust, and I like to say parked on the sidelines. Where's that? Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, conservative allocations, and especially if you think the marketplace is high, because the stock market is also, you think, high as well. But you can put it into safe, protected investments. Now, when the market shifts, now you can purchase real estate, we call at a discount or optimal timing, because we think you can find a deal just about any marketplace given enough time or when the market shifts. So imagine that $10 million property that you wanted to buy today is now worth $9 million a couple of years from now because the market shift. And with that, you can purchase, you can form an LLC and literally purchase with your deferred sales trust this investment property. And the neat part is you have a brand new depreciation schedule, which leads into the second advantage over the 1031 exchange. And the 1031 exchange, you've not only sold and bought another property, but your depreciation schedule has traveled. So one of the best reasons to own investment real estate or a business is the depreciation to offset the income. What does that mean? Well, for every dollar I bring in, I may be able to offset 10 cents of that with depreciation per year. Although if I ever sell, I get recaptured and I owe it on that tax. So the 1031 exchange, that basis is what it's known as, starts to get lower and lower and lower the more depreciation I take. But when I sell, the basis moves. That's not good. Okay. So let's imagine you sold a $10 million property that was fully depreciated. If you bought the same 1031 property via a 1031 exchange, you'd have no basis and no depreciation to offset any of that income. However, if you bought that same property using the deferred sales trust and you went that route, you'd have a brand new depreciation schedule, which is very, very powerful part of the strategy. So I'm going to pause there since I just mentioned those two. See if you have any questions or thoughts, Kirk.
You're really digging into some areas that are, I think, really important. And I think for most investors, you may be kind of going over some people's heads. If they don't really fully understand, you're talking about recapture and things like that. Kind of put it simply, if you're looking at this from a tax perspective, right, this is, let me just relate a quick story. So I have some friends and clients who are real estate investors. Some of them are real old, sharp people, like people have been around the block a few times. You know, you look at them, you say, those guys know what's going on. Those type of people, right? Different generation. And these are people who have always done a 1031. From the time they started real estate to now, they just 1031 it. They never want to pay the taxes. And recently, 2 years ago, they actually ended up selling their properties and paying the taxes because they felt that it would be better to sell and pay the taxes than to have to 1031 it into something that they'd have to sit in real estate and then the market crashes and then there's no advantage there. Like you said, there's no flexibility. So that was for them, that was their solution. Now, they did this without my knowledge because they were doing their own thing and they always make their own decisions. But I think that's an important point that you're talking about is that it's another tool in your toolbox as a way to go about this to get some tax benefits. So you think real estate is one of the better investments to utilize with the DST from your experience?
I think investment real estate is hands down the best risk-adjusted rate of return that you can achieve, plus the appreciation, plus the depreciation that offsets it. In particular, my focus is multifamily. I love mobile home parks and I love senior housing. So in those three sectors, those are my favorite and I've found the best for me. But people have different, you know, levels of comfort and different levels of expertise. What we love about the deferred sales trust is it really opens up to just about anything. No Bitcoin, nothing overseas, no primary homes, but anything that trades on the New York Stock Exchange, any investment real estate, you can go into lending with the funds. You can also go back into another business venture. You can develop commercial real estate from the ground up with the funds. And the key is it's all tax deferred and it's at optimal timing, meaning whenever you want. And also a key point here too, it's out of debt. Part of what you were explaining for some of your clients, I have clients like that in the past as well, who sold and part of what they wanted to do is not overpay, but also get out of debt. Because in 2008, what happened? The people who got hurt the most took on too much debt. So they sold equal or greater value with the 1031, and they took on equal or greater debt on the next property. So we like to say the deferred sales trust is the debt-free plan for your commercial real estate or business in that you can sell and get out of all of it, get debt-free, get on the sidelines. And then this is the key. As soon as you're there, you can diversify, right? You can diversify. Instead of being in one single property and one single location, you can diversify across 10 different commercial real estate syndications in 5 different parts of the country, right? Into mobile home parks, into senior housing, into retail. And then the other 50% of the funds you can put into stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. So having diversification lowers your risk, right? Getting out of debt lowers your risk. And we just want to help people escape feeling trapped by capital gains taxes, which leads into the internal motivations for a lot of our clients. A lot of them are baby boomers and they've made their wealth. In fact, here's a key stat for you and your listeners. According to the American Bankers Association, there's about $17 trillion, which will pass from one generation to the next in the next 20 years. And this is known as the largest wealth transfer in the history of the planet. And this is the baby boomers. In fact, there are about 10,000 baby boomers every day turning 65 in the U.S. alone. And there's about 77 million baby boomers in the U.S. alone. And so what are they challenged with? They're challenged with the toilets, the trash, the liability, the employees, the ever-changing economy, ever-changing rules and regulations. And they've made their wealth. They just feel trapped because they don't know if they're going to sell to get hammered by 30 to 50% of their gain. It's hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in capital gains tax. And they want to pass it on to the next generation. They want to be good stewards with what they've been given and what they've been able to earn and give more to charity and give more to their family and other causes. But they feel trapped. They feel like they can't sell because they're going to get hit with that tax. And so we come in and we say, hey, pay off all your debt, be tax deferred, be liquid, be diversified, and let's start this new thing for you. Although we've done it for 24 years, let's start this new tax-deferred wealth plan so that you can start a legacy of wealth that all of what you've earned, and you can also retire today, right? You can get what your internal motivations are, which are, for some of them, we just did a house sale in Cupertino. She lived about 3.5 miles away from Apple. Been there for 20 years, you know, bought it very low and was selling it for about $3 million. Above her 121 exclusion, which is essentially if you live anywhere for two of the last 5 years for a primary home, you have $250,000 if you're single or $500 if you're married, but for capital gains tax. But anything above that is taxable. So for her, above her exclusion, she had about a $500,000 liability. She wanted to move and relocate and downsize her house, but she felt trapped because she didn't want to pay that tax. Well, enter the deferred sales trust. We have the solution for that. She was able to sell, put it into a retirement account, now get a passive income stream coming in and have an extra $500,000 to do that. So the same thing works for, again, the primary homeowner, for the business owner and also for the commercial real estate owner or other things such as artwork or collectibles that are highly appreciated as well.
So you touched on a lot of stuff, and I want to kind of go back to a few of them. So let's start with restrictions. So what are some restrictions of things that you can invest in inside of a DST?
Yeah, so it's got to be based upon the risk tolerance, right, Kirk? So you fill that out, and those 12 questions and that document becomes kind of the constitution for how and where the funds are invested. So the first thing we say is, okay, let's imagine you had an 8% moderate risk over a 10-year period of time. We're going to look at that and we're going to say, okay, Kirk, this is what was filled out, 2 years ago. And this is what the financial you signed off on. This is good. Now, if there's something that's ultra risky, we would say two things. Either we readjust the risk tolerance questionnaire, or how about you just pay the tax on that amount and go do that. Our goal and our role is to make sure that the financial advisor is paying you back the agreed upon target that we had hoped for, right? And doing that by investing in suitable investments, okay? So that's the first thing. So that being said, if you said, hey, I want to go into Bitcoin, we'd say, pay the tax and go on Bitcoin sideways. I want to go overseas, we'd say that's too risky overseas. We don't want to put the risk on the trust and on being able to pay you back and also on the failing for any of our clients. So basically overseas and the last one, Bitcoin, and the last one would be primary homes. And the reason for primary homes is it's considered constructive receipt. Same reason you can't 1031 into a primary home. The government basically says, no, you're doing that for your own purpose. It's personal property. Therefore, it's taxable. The government puts these tax legal loopholes in place, by the way, so that money continues to flow. It's a study of macroeconomics. They don't want Kirk to sell his business for $10 million, put all the money under his mattress and not stimulate the economy. But if they can do a legal loophole that says, hey, $10 million into the deferred sales trust, invest it into all these companies, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, invest it into commercial real estate or new business venture, that's actually going to produce more tax revenue because it's going to produce more jobs and it's going to keep the economy going stronger. So that's why these legal loopholes are in place. That's why it's legal. That's why it works.
Okay. So really the primary residence is the only real restriction. I think you might have a different definition of risk than I would. I would say Bitcoin is not risky or not risky. It's how much you put into it. If you're putting 100% into Bitcoin, that might be considered risky. If you're putting 1%, I think it'd be hard to argue that that's risky. So I think the question I was asking was really, what can you not invest it in? Now, you guys might have a different viewpoint on that. And I guess that's another question, because overseas is not risky either. There's a concept that a lot of people talk about, which is home country bias, whereas people in this country, 70% of them have most, if not all, of their money in the U.S. Every single country has the same thing. But if you look at a global economy, we would have about 40% of the investments in US and the rest would be international. So you're saying that you perceive overseas as risky. Is that your perception or is that the DST?
So when I say overseas, I just mean real estate ventures overseas, right?
Okay.
A speculative real estate development overseas. We like to say in the United States, real estate investments are fine, right? But if it's overseas or out of the country, real estate investments. As far as the stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or anything that trades, again, on the New York Stock Exchange, there's international funds, that's all fine. So that's not there. But what we don't want is to put too much risk where, let's say, it was a hotel in Brazil on the beach, ground up development. development opportunity, we would say, if you want to do that, pay the tax on whatever portion that is and then go do that. Let's not do that in the trust because we think it could potentially be too much risk, which again could put the structure in jeopardy for the future and our track record, which we really want to protect, if that makes sense.
No, I understand that. So what are some of the downsides of using this as a method for people?
If you own a primary home or a business, that's the most value you have because there's really not a lot of others that we found that offers the flexibility, the liquidity, the diversification that we offer, as well as the tax deferral. If you own commercial real estate, you know, you have the 1031 option, and I still help people do 1031 exchanges. If they can find a 1031 deal that makes sense, hey, go for it, buy it. We want to reward you there. We're a backup plan for a failed 1031. So we say, hey, work with us regardless, get everything set up, ready to go. We don't charge anything unless you do the deal. Work with our QI companies, qualified intermediaries, who have both options for you just in case your deal fails. So for the people who already have a good tax deferral strategy, such as the 1031, great. So the other downsides would be it's new, right? It's the biggest thing is it's new for people. There are ongoing fees. You know, we think our fees are commercially reasonable and we try to keep them as low as we can, but there's ongoing fees. But our goal is to, again, earn about 6.5% after fees. And that's to the financial advisor and to our company as a trustee. Other than that, the tax liability has to be big enough, Kirk, right? If your tax liability is not big enough to offset our fees, then it just doesn't make sense, right? And we'll be the first one to say that. For example, our minimum is $500,000 proceeds, and the minimum tax liability is about $100,000 in tax liability. So if you're not hitting those parameters, it's already not a good deal. We'll say no to it and say, just pay your tax. Our average deal is about $2.6 million, and we're helping defer about $500,000 in tax for that size of a deal. So that's really it. I mean, really, it's opportunity cost. Do you pay the tax or do you not? And the next thing is, well, what other tax deferral strategy can I offer? There are a few other ones out there, by the way, the monetized installment sale, a charitable remainder trust, and a few other ones. Now, the charitable, it's tried and true. We like that. The monetized, you'd have to ask yourself some questions about their track record and the legality behind it and make sure that you're protected there. Our tax attorneys provide audit defense, and they also provide indemnification for the clients, basically meaning they stand behind their work. Whoever you're looking at, you want to make sure the downside for you could be, what happens if I get an IRS audit? What happens if they potentially change the laws? If they change the laws, that could be a detriment, right? Right now, it goes back to the 1920s, but they could change something, you never know. But as it stands right now, and it has for 24 years, we've been able to make it work.
You mentioned in terms of the fees and the minimums. So how do you kind of judge whether your fees make sense? Do you have like a percentage, or you charge a percentage, you charge a fixed amount, or how does that work?
We use the rule of 72, which states that if I can earn 7% on any given amount and let that compound over a 10-year period of time, that amount will double. So let's take you back to your $10 million scenario, Kirk. Imagine you're selling your business and you come to us for the first time. And I say, Kirk, okay, it looks like you have about a $4 million tax liability. Let's imagine you had a zero basis and about depreciation recapture, capital gains tax, Obamacare, and the state capital gains tax, it's about 40%. So do you want $6 million by yourself, or would you like to put $10 million minus some fees into the trust? In that scenario, we think it's substantial because you can pay a $4 million fee to the government, essentially tax, or the government can give you that $4 million or allow you to keep it deferred and charge you 0% as long as you put it into stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and then you can live off the interest. So we always start right there. And then we say, okay, well, we're going to hope to earn about 8, Kirk, and again, net about 6.5%. Our ongoing fee is about 1.5%. The setup fees are about 1.5% to the tax attorney. It's a one-time fee and covers a legal audit defense for the life of the trust, which again, I think is the most important part here. That's for the entire life of the trust. And then you're paying the trustee fee and the financial advising fee, which is about 1.5% recurring. And so you look at those two, and then again, after fees, if we can out-earn all of that, that $10 million, let's just say in 10 years, will be $20 million. And then if we do that for another 10 years, it'd be $40 million, right? So that's the idea. And if you do the math, it speaks for itself.
This is great. Are there any other assets that would be good for this? Like people who have, let's say their company went public and they just had a huge windfall for selling shares of their stock. Does it work for things like that too?
100%. Yeah, we're doing lots of deals like that. People are selling, and we call it the go fund yourself, because a lot of these tech entrepreneurs or business owners, they actually want to go create another one. And so especially for the Silicon Valley, where they feel like they're trapped through these big corporations who are going to give them all these stock in basically a tax-deferred way, but they're locked in with them for a period of years, they can say, look, we don't need that. We're actually going to use the deferred sales trust, and we're going to use that to fund our next venture. And then, oh, by the way, they can invest those funds into their stocks separately, right? So it creates freedom for entrepreneurs to go create and preserve their more wealth by starting a new business venture. But even better, you can put it into cash flow investment real estate and get the depreciation to offset the income. So those are really unique advantages for our clients.
So how much time do you need? Let's say I sell my stock today. How much time do I have to actually take advantage of the DST tax benefits?
Okay, it all depends. If you're selling stock or selling a company or selling a primary home, it does not qualify for a 1031 exchange, right? So we're in this category over here, meaning we need to be early. Okay, if you've already sold your stock or sold your business, or even if the buyer has removed all contingencies and there's nothing holding up escrow from sending you the money, it's too late for the deferred sales trust. So this is very important. You need to come and engage with us early. Okay, and again, we don't charge anything unless you do the deal and unless the deal closes. And for whatever reason you change your mind, you don't owe us a dollar to the tax attorneys or capital gains tax solutions or anybody else. But we need to be early. We need to insert language into the deferred sales trust so that you have that option. Here's why. Because the IRS wants to know that the intent for Kirk was indeed to do a tax deferral strategy. And he didn't just throw it in the last minute. If you throw it in the last minute, they could say it doesn't work, right? It's failed and it's due. So be early with that. And so how much time do we need? And we've done deals in 72 hours, but nobody wants to work on a fire drill. We want to meet you early, typically within 30 days before anything sells, really even 6 months before you close. Get to know us, get educated, get your trusted advisors in. And that's the other thing too. We don't want you to just take our track record for it or our advice for it. Bring in your trusted advisors, okay? They're the CPAs and tax attorneys. We call those the brain surgeons. And make sure the brain surgeons get with our brain surgeons and make sure it's a good fit for you, okay? Again, my role is just the nurse. I take the pulse. I know enough to be dangerous. Yes, I do consider myself an expert in the deferred sales trust, but the people who are actually doing the surgery, the people that you need to get to say yes, whoever that person you need to say yes, bring them in and make sure that that's a good fit. And so generally, I'd say 30 to 45 days before close of escrow is good. You know, a week or two is good. That helps us to really educate you and get everything in place.
Great. Well, we really appreciate having you on, Brett. Any kind of final thoughts on where people can learn more about you and your DST?
Yes. Thanks, Kirk. You can go to capitalgainstaxsolutions.com. And I have a free guide called the Escape Capital Gains Tax. And essentially, it's going to walk you through the how, the why, and some examples of the deferred sales trust. You can also go to YouTube or LinkedIn and search for Capital Gains Tax Solutions. I have a YouTube channel. We have, you know, 3 to 5 minute videos that break down a lot of these topics on the deferred sales trust. And then I'm also launching my podcast, Capital Gains Tax Solutions Podcast, where you can hear alternative strategies and kind of compare and contrast from experts who are helping their clients do the same thing with different strategies.
So that was a great interview with Brett Swartz. So now we're on to the panel portion of our show. This week, we have more panelists than normal. We've got a returning panelist. We have Barbara Freeberg. How you doing, Barb?
Doing great, Kirk. Thanks to have me on.
Great. Well, glad to have you. We also have another returning, Megan Gorman. How you doing, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. Looking forward to chatting about the wonderful world of tax, which is where DSTs live in.
Glad to have you on. And also our third returning panelist, Kelly Coughlin. How you doing, Kelly?
Great, Kirk. Nice to be here. Nice to join with the rest of the group.
We wanted to make sure we had Megan and Kelly on this show because this topic is, I think, a really interesting topic. It gets into our kind of theme of tax loopholes of the rich. And when we talk about some of these more complex type of transactions, it's good to have two tax experts on the panel to kind of talk about the pros and cons of doing such a thing or any similar type of transaction. So I guess let's start with Megan. So Megan, talking about the DST, and just for reference, the DST has two separate names. This case is the Deferred Sales Trust. But if you actually Google DST, it's actually referred to as a Delaware statutory trust as well. So there's other reference points for that. So just so you know, if you're looking it up, don't get confused. They are different things.
Yes, we are talking about deferred sales trusts.
Yes.
Yeah. I love tax ideas, right? I think that for anybody who is going through a transaction, it is really important to understand what's out there. Because as Americans, it's our nature to hate taxation. And what everyone has to keep in mind, and I think Kelly would probably agree, is that good tax planning is really understanding of timing. Do you accelerate something or do you defer it? And so, you know, this type of concept is interesting because it falls into the deferral column, which is right in the name of the title of it. But I think it's one of those ideas that you have to explore and be cautious, because while we all hate to pay taxes, and by the way, if someone does like paying taxes, let me know, but we all hate paying taxes, when we start to go down the path of trying to find ways to defer taxation, we take on complexity and we take on the chance that the IRS might not always agree with our decision to defer taxation. And so when you think about this, first of all, you should not go down the path of this technique without speaking to a CPA or a tax attorney. This is complicated, and you're signing yourself up for a period of time. But this tax technique comes down to a concept that I think it's good to understand, which is, what is constructive receipt, right? And constructive receipt is, from an income tax perspective, when a cash basis taxpayer has received gross income. And so what you're trying to do in this technique is not receive the income so that you cause a taxable transaction, but to get use of the income and receive it over a long period of time, which allows you to defer taxation. And that sounds very simple and straightforward, but it brings up a whole host of issues. And since, Kelly, you're on the call, I don't know if you want to jump in and sort of talk about some of the risks or if you want me to go down that path.
Yeah, Megan, I'm going to let you focus on more or less the tax components of this, because I think you hit everything right on the head, so there's no point in me echoing that. If they're going to do a transaction, make sure you do it properly. That's kind of the technical structuring part of the deal. What I'd like to just hit on is, A, don't let taxes drive a decision like this. That's a bad idea. I've said this before, I think in at least one or two of these interviews or participation in the podcast, in Kirk's podcast. Don't let tax drive these decisions. They can enhance a good investment decision, but it better be a good investment decision. So from that perspective, in these DST deals, there's some things that, from a tax perspective, they sound terrific. It's like a installment sale on steroids, or a 1031, enhanced 1031, which is normally real estate stuff. So it's got some really attractive tax components. That being said, it has some significant risk components that need to be addressed. And at the risk of sounding redundant to one of the other podcasts, this transparency, liquidity, custody thing, liquidity, in my mind, is an issue. That once you structure one of these things, then getting your money out, is that a problem? And then you got a creditor risk here. At the end of the day, if you participate in one of these things, you're a creditor of whoever it is on the contra side of the transaction. And you better be comfortable that that creditor-debtor relationship is good. One final thing I'll say, they break kind of a fundamental belief I have that when any of us that have had businesses or property that we try to exit from, let's say we've grown our business, want to sell it for $10 million, the goal is to try to get cashed out. Everybody wants to get cashed out. This kind of goes against that. You're saying, oh, I don't need to get cashed out, right? I'll carry a note on it. And that's kind of what you're doing. You're carrying a note, not to the party that bought it really, but it's to this interposing party. And that kind of gets my attention.
Kelly, I think you bring a good point about risk. And I think one of the things that most people have to get their heads around is that when you're going down the path of tax, you've got to really think about the character of income here and the character of taxation, because people are trying to avoid taxes, but you're trying to avoid taxes, you know, potentially on ordinary income, capital gain income. And in these deferred sales trusts, the type of income that I get most nervous about is depreciation recapture. As listeners know, when you sell property that's been used in business, you have to recapture the depreciation. on that property. And so that's often where some of the big tax burn occurs. And what isn't always clear in this is in some instances, you don't always get to shelter the depreciation recapture, or you don't get to shelter all the depreciation recapture with a deferred sales trust. Now, the devil is always in the details. And this is why I think one of the key risks here is sitting down with a CPA and having them pencil out the true net benefit of doing this technique. Because I think that's where people can get burned, is not understanding that not all taxes may always be sheltered in these instances.
I agree completely. The net benefit, and that's fairly easy transaction for those of us in the business to do that. On the other side of the journal entry is what's the cost? And that's kind of a little more nebulous. You certainly have the transaction cost of structuring the deal, structuring the DST, the legal and accounting fees to participate. And however those things are charged, I don't know whether it's asset-based or transaction-based, whatever. So, but that's just one component. You have a risk cost in there. You have a lack of liquidity cost that's in there. And both should be put in the T account or the journal entry to make sure that it's fully understood.
Kelly, you and I are tax people. Kirk and Barb, from your perspective, I'd be curious to hear what you think about deferred sales trusts.
Well, let's start with Barb. I definitely have opinions, but Barb, let's get you in the conversation. What are your thoughts, Barb?
Well, the one thing I want to figure out is, and I'm not 100% clear on this, is how does this relate to an ordinary investor? Can they get in on this in any way, or is this simply a deal between the person selling the business and the creator of the DST? So help me understand that basic point.
I think you typically see these in very large transactions. So, you know, if you think about what happens when you have a business or investment property and you want to sell, you can, one, recognize the gain and move on from there. Two, a very common technique is something like a 1031 exchange. But that means you're exchanging property for other like-kind property, but deferring the taxation. And then there's this situation, which allows you to sell a property and take liquidity. I think that for a lot of investors out there, this is not the right fit, right? It is a very distinct type of profile. And there was one thing that Brett said in the interview, I picked up on it right in the beginning, but he said he was based in Sacramento. Barb, you and I are Californians. And when I think of Sacramento, I think of driving all the way out there and you're driving through ag country. California is a huge agricultural center in the United States. And so when I think about deferred sales trusts, and I think about where Brett's located, I think it gives you a good understanding of the type of person who could benefit under this technique, which is someone who has a very large track of business property in agriculture. And they might be the one types of people who would use this as a way of, you know, getting liquidity after they sell it and deferring taxation.
Except, Megan, I think one has to be careful. You're really, what's the key component of this technically is that they're not getting liquidity. That's the important.
But they're getting an income stream over a period of years.
Yes, they're getting an income stream, and that gets distributed among principal and gain as a traditional installment sale. But so when somebody says, oh, you get liquidity, that means I sell the asset for $100,000. I see $100,000 that goes into my money market account. That's liquidity.
Okay, so I'm looking at it differently because I see an income stream coming from the trust over a period of years of having an income stream. So I'll redefine that as an income stream versus liquidity.
Yes.
But to your point, yes, you're not going to have the money in your account. But I think going back to your point about the cost, if this was a $100,000 transaction, it's not worth the cost of setting up a DST trust. If this is a $10 million transaction, the cost may be justified. And I think Brett sort of gave a scenario like that. And I could see in a place like California with someone selling a business or property here, it becomes a sexier concept.
I don't know I don't really have a good idea of what the costs, the kind of out-of-pocket costs are to set these things up. But it seems to make sense that, you know, you wouldn't do it for a $100,000 piece of property, but for a $10 million, probably you could do that.
Well, and my understanding of Brett's role is he is merely the trustee. that you also would have potentially an investment person who does the actual management of the assets. So, I mean, probably there's some set trustee fee based on the value of the asset in the trust. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of setting this up, I'm sure it's, you know, the cost of a CPA and a cost of an attorney. Remember, once you set up a trust, you're setting up a taxable entity. So I think that the initial outlay could be significant. And that's why running the numbers and seeing net, net, how does it play out? Does it work for you?
And the way I look at it is, and just taking it down a different tack, because obviously costs are important. You know, I don't have the tax background that you, Megan, or Kelly have. So the way I look at it is, that is a question for the experts that I would leave up to, you know, listeners, for your own tax experts, tax attorney or accountant. But the way I look at it from a risk management perspective is, this sounds really good. It sounds like a really good idea. But if you kind of get beneath the surface, it raises a lot of questions. And I'm not judging whether this is a good idea or not, but I'm just saying that the questions I would ask are things like, great, so this works, says who? If you get into these, we call them tax loopholes of the rich, you get into these kind of transactions, there are people who come up with transactions that are new, and some come up with questionable ones, and then some are ones that have been tested in tax court and they're really solid. So the way I look at it is not a binary thing. I look at it as degrees, right? So if you're coming up with some tax strategy, some international tax strategy to avoid tax, and it's never been tested in court, there's no private letter ruling, to me that seems questionable, right? Because you just don't know the outcome. You don't know if the IRS is going to look at this and say, oh, it's a scam, or whether they're going to say, oh, no, we agree. So when I'm looking at these type of things, there are certain types of transactions that actually you can look at and say, all right, there's a lot of private letter rulings on this. There's a lot of tax court cases. I feel really confident that this is going to hold up under scrutiny. But when you actually find something new, even though it may be completely sound, and I'm not judging one way or the other for the DST, but let's just say it's sound, if there is no private letter ruling, if there's no tax court cases to support it, you have to really question the type of plan. And it really requires a good accountant or tax attorney to give you a very strong opinion one way or the other. Because even in that, it's not a question of yes or no, it's a question of degrees. You might say, all right, there's definitely some risks on this. If you're willing to take that risk, then okay. But if you're not, they'll give you an opinion. And I think that's a really important opinion to take consider, because it's not something that most people without that background have an understanding or an ability to diagnose. I guess that's kind of how I looked at it, is this is something that it would require a lot more diligence and conversations with tax attorneys and accountants to really assess whether this is something that would hold up under scrutiny. Megan, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I think whenever you go down the path of doing a technique, you have to, from a risk management perspective, which I know is Kelly's wheelhouse, talk to them about the risks involved and potential for audit, and making sure in these types of transactions that you build the correct file to be able to support your position. The other thing with the deferred sales trusts is you've got to think about how much hassle and administration it's going to be. And then also ask them to run a negative scenario. They talk about getting a certain rate of return over a period of years. What happens if that rate of return doesn't happen? And I bring this up because over the years, I've seen things like CRTs and other type of taxable structures, or tax deferral structures, or tax beneficial structures, be promised at a certain rate of return, and it doesn't actually happen. And then the person walks away feeling incredibly frustrated. And Kelly, I'm assuming you've seen that as well over the years.
Yeah, I have. And Kirk, to your point, I do think that that is a valid risk or something to be concerned with, or at least cognizant of. But I actually would be more concerned about the custody of the assets, the creditor-debtor relationship. Because these deals are, at the end of the day, when you sort through all the bells and whistles on the DST, at their core, I see them as simply installment sales. And IRC, I think it's 453, covers that. It's been around a long time. that's pretty much proven ground that as long as you don't have actual or constructive receipt of cash from a deal and there's no related party type thing going on, as long as you don't have receipt of the cash on this, then you will get the tax benefit. But that means if you're not getting the cash, somebody else is holding that cash. And that's where I see the hair around these things can be. If you're not getting your own cash, as in you're not getting cashed out, somebody's holding on to that cash. I want to know who's holding on to it. Can I see what's happening with it? And if I want to get out of it, scuttle the whole thing, terminate it, pay the tax because I don't like what's going on. I don't like the condition of the custodian. I don't like what's going on in the investment side. I just don't like the way it smells anymore. I don't like the, maybe there's some initiatives going on in Congress. I want to be able to get out of it. So that's that, back to that TLC thing. If I want to close, get out of the deal, that's liquidity. That's true liquidity, not partial through a payment stream. That's where I see the real risk in this is.
You make a really good point that I think probably a lot of people will overlook, but the custody part I want to mention. We do a lot of diligence on different custodians, and we really kind of do a deep dive on them, especially in the alternative space. And we just got notice from a new client that had nothing to do with us, but that one of the custodians they were using just apparently was liquidating. I don't know the details. I'm not going to say the name because I don't have the details, but the point is this custodian was liquidating, and we've seen this in the past. Sometimes it's for reasons that they just couldn't continue business. Sometimes it's a reason because there's some shenanigans going on. But, you know, in this case, the money was transferred to another custodian, but you don't know what's going on. And Kelly's point's really important that you need to know where your money is. If it's in one of the bigger companies that you're a little bit more familiar, you know, maybe a little more established, then you can feel a little bit better at it. But the custody is really important. You can't just take somebody's word for it that it's going to be in some safe space. And let me give you one quick example, and I want to get to Barb too. We saw this a few years back that there's this advertisement of this person saying, oh, you can put gold in your IRA and store it in your house. Well, that's not allowed. It's not even close to allowed. But yet somebody was out there advertising that. And of course, they were selling you their gold. And they're out there advertising that. And they were actually interviewed by the Wall Street Journal. And they had people on the other side of that interviewed saying that clearly this is not allowed. And the person's like, no, you can do it. You can absolutely do it. You know, you can't take people's words for it and you can get burned. And I think that's kind of the reality with a lot of these type of things. And this is not a reflection on Brett or anybody else. It's just a reality of any situation you deal with. You have to do your own research. You have to know, like what Kelly said, where all the pieces are, the custody. You have to understand how it's structured. If you're not comfortable with it, then pull your money out. Like, it's a really important concept. So Barb, what are your kind of thoughts on all this so far?
Okay, so on an overview, I think, first of all, whenever you make any kind of financial transaction, like we've been discussing, you really have to know who you're dealing with. You have to understand what their track record is and how viable they are. So that requires a tremendous amount of due diligence, particularly when you're dealing with huge sums of money. Then when you're selling your business, you also have to consider, what are my other alternatives? Okay, one alternative is to take the lump sum, huge amount of cash, pay your close to 40% tax on it, and you're done. Okay, you've got your money and you can do with what you want with it, and you have paid your tax obligation. Another option that people who are looking to sell a business might want to consider is having the buyer hold some of the paper. So you can also structure a deal with the person who is buying your business. And that, in some cases, depending on the size and the needs of both parties, may be a simpler way to approach this and just not string out the sale over 10, 20, 30 years, which to me seems kind of scary because there's so many unknowns and you want to ultimately get your money. So structuring a shorter term deal with the buyer is another thing to consider when you're in the position of selling a large business.
Barb, that's interesting you bring that up because I'll tell you a quick story. My father-in-law he's now, I guess when he sold his business, his auto business, about 25, 30 years ago, sold it as an installment sale where he held the note on the property. And it was a 30-year note, I believe, that was set to expire when he turned 95. And he just recently turned 97. So when he put that in place, I don't think he ever thought he'd be alive at 30 years later. He was trying to get an income stream for my mother-in-law. But it was interesting watching that play out so successfully and how that acted as a pension for them in retirement.
And actually, I have a personal case as well. My parents owned a very big apartment complex, and they sold it on an installment sale. And after my father passed, my mother loved having the income stream. She loved it. And before my mother passed, the seller said, hey, we're refinancing. We want to cash out and give you the money for the balance due. And she was like, really? I like the cash flow. But that was very successful. And it worked out very well. And of course, you have the collateral of the business. And if the buyer defaulted, she owned the property.
Yeah, that's great. One final question, we'll kind of wrap it up here. So we're talking about real estate. With the DST as an example versus like a 1031, what are your thoughts? So whether it's a 1031 or another similar type of transaction, what are your thoughts on this using a 1031 versus DST or maybe some other structure that may also be appropriate for people to consider for these type of things?
Well, 1031 typically is for real estate, so it's like kinds. If you don't want to get into a similar deal, then that wouldn't be an option. So I think these are mainly designed for, first of all, identify what the asset is. And I think Barb's point about the buyer being the debtor in the situation is a great idea, where the seller carries a contract. That's been done for a long, long time. I know a handful of people that love taking contract for deed. That's the kind of the plain vanilla term for it. Sell a piece of property, carry the contract, and they hope the deal fails because they collect a down payment of, say it's $100,000 property, they collect $10,000, $20,000, and they just get monthly payments at a higher interest rate, and that works. The only time it can go south is if the property gets beat to hell, right? And then the buyer trashes the property, and then you got to put more than $10,000 into it. That's where, you know, you got to have some covenants in there to kind of protect it. So contract for deed is a great way. Otherwise, this is just kind of a, you know, it's an installment sale. You can do an installment sale on any type of asset. The main thing you got to be careful of is that you can't do it with a related party and get the tax benefits, because that's the constructive receipt, I believe. Obviously, you can't get the cash. So you got to leave the cash in the hands of people. So I'll go back to my mantra, is that cash is king. Take cash if you can get it. And if it costs you a little bit of tax, pay the penalty, pay the tax.
I think as we kind of look at this, I mean, if it's real estate and you have to take it back, then it's an asset, assuming it doesn't get, you know, all beat up. With a business, anything could happen with a new buyer, right? I mean, they could totally not know what they're doing, and you know, you may want to sell the business for a reason. So taking back paper with a business might not be as appealing as with maybe real estate.
Exactly. Right. There's a lot of ways management can mess up a business. And I would posit that that probably happens more often than it doesn't happen. Was Barb or Megan talking about the garage? Who was talking about that?
Me, Megan.
Megan, were you talking about that? Yeah, that's a great story. That's a terrific story. But I wouldn't say that's the norm. Those are the kind of things that could end up, your father sells it and the buyer doesn't show up to work on time, doesn't have the same work ethic, you know, the whole different, especially if it's like generational type things, you could, those things can end up badly. That's terrific. Yours ended up great.
So Megan, what are your thoughts? We can maybe kind of do some final thoughts here too.
Yeah, I think final thoughts is there's elegance in simplicity. And I say this to clients all the time, because we do go through ideas like this and we do the analysis and we run the numbers. Sometimes it's better just to keep it simple and straightforward. I think that DSTs work for a very distinct group of taxpayers, but they really, really have to understand what they're getting into, commit to it, and be aware that there's going to be some benefits to it and some real negatives to it. But I think for the majority of people, this isn't a great fit for them. And I think it's always best to have things that are very straightforward and easy to explain and comprehend.
Great. And where can people find more about you, Megan?
You can find me at www.thewealthintersection.com, on Instagram, The Wealth Intersection, and on Twitter at Wealth Intersect. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. Barbara, what about you? Final thoughts?
I'd like to echo what Kelly and Megan said. 2 points. One, don't ever let taxes drive an investment decision, because you have to invest any investment decision on its own merits. Second, simplicity is a virtue. Simplicity just makes life overall a lot easier. So you want to be really cautious before you go into a very complicated transaction and do your due diligence. Third, you've got to pay taxes at some point. And sometimes it's easier, as Kelly had mentioned, to just bite the bullet and pay taxes and move on. You can find me at Robo Advisor Pros, where I showcase digital investment advisors, review them, and help you manage your money in an affordable way. And also at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance. Thanks, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. And Kelly, final thoughts and where people can find more about you.
I think my final thought would be this. When you do a DST type transaction, you really are entering into a whole new type of investment. You're changing many of the features and characteristics of the original investment. So I would make sure that investors that are going to do this transaction, they recognize that it's no longer the same deal. It may feel like it's the same thing. You know, it may feel like whatever that asset was that they're deferring into this DST type entity, that it's the same. It's not. It's got many features and characteristics that are different. The risk is different. The counterparty side of this is different. The liquidity is different. So many things are different. It's a totally new investment, really. It may look like it's the same, but it's not. And so because it's a whole new investment, it's almost as if they sold that asset and then they bought a different type of asset. I think it's fundamentally that different. And anytime they do that, they need to recognize that, okay, this is a whole new investment. So I got to do what Barb said, do the due diligence. This is a whole new deal. Do your due diligence on this and then apply what I've been saying for like the 15th time. Transparency, make sure you can see what you got. Liquidity, can you get out of it? Custody, make sure whoever's holding that isn't good for him. You can get a hold of me at Kelly@EverydayCPA. I'm the CEO of Everyday CPA, a national accounting firm. And you can also get me at Kelly@InnovativeWealth.com. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for coming on, Kelly. My final thoughts here are, you know, this is a great idea, DSTs, and certainly there's different derivatives of this. You know, they're basically created around the installment sale. I would say really the big takeaway is make sure your accountant or your tax attorney is comfortable with this and that you're comfortable with their assessment of it. You know, we don't make determinations whether things are good or bad, but I think there's risk in everything and degrees of everything, and you just need to understand what you're getting into. So if you can understand it and you feel comfortable with it, great. If you're not comfortable with it, then do something else. Make sure you kind of follow the guidelines. You know, as Kelly said, with a little bit of TLC into your investment, you can find me at Innovative Advisor Group at innovativewealth.com. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. Of course, you can find me every week here on the show. So thanks again for coming on the show this week. You know, we love having you listening to the show, and I think we had a lot of fun this panel. So please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll be able to access all our resources, show notes, and the archive shows. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.